Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. So today's sutta is the Nirvapa Sutta, number 25, as suggested 2 weeks ago. And just as a prologue to this sutta, it starts to describe some very interesting ideas in Buddhism about, first of all, the idea or the concept of Mara and the five-sense world, and the ideas of the problem of human beings is attachment to that five-sense world and how to get beyond that five-sense world. But first of all, before I get into the sutta, for those of you who don't know much about this character which permeates Buddhist suttas called Mara, Mara was a god in one of the levels, the temporary gods, in one of the cosmological levels in Buddhism, which was just below the Brahma gods. And the realm of which Mara was the chief was called the Paranimitta Vasavati realm, literally which means the gods who wield power over others' creations. And if you have an idea of the different levels of pleasure which human beings seek, one of the higher pleasures, which is even more important than the gaining of wealth or sensual pleasures, is the pleasure of exerting power. It is a type of power trip, as we say in the Western world. And you can see that many people, once they have enough money, once they have enough sensory pleasures, very often they go into seeking the pleasure of power. And so this being who's supposed to exist, it's not a metaphorical being, it's an existing being, is a being who exerts power over others, a control freak in chief. And here we look in Buddhism, we see this as, again, a real figure and also a metaphorical figure, but here we're talking about the real figure. It's whenever there's a controlling happens in your mind or in your life, that is almost like a manifestation of Mara, the controller inside of you. And the controller leads to craving, and the craving leads to attachments. It's what gets you stuck in this world, which is why in Buddhism the opposite of controlling is called letting go. And letting go is getting beyond the sphere of the controller, of Mara. Now in this particular sutta here, the Buddha is addressing the monks and detailing how one gets beyond the control of the controller, how one gets beyond Mara, and by so doing, how one gets beyond attachment. It is especially apt for monks and nuns, because it shows you that, you know, that as a monk or a nun, or anybody who's trying to aspire towards enlightenment, we still have a little bit involvement in the world, but because that's a necessity. But how can you be involved in the world without getting attached to it? And how can you eat food, or how, like I was doing last week, go to this five-star resort in Bali without getting attached to it? Now how can you do these things? And here the Buddha gives the answer with a simile of four herds of deer, and Mara being like a hunter who tries to trap the deer. And obviously the deer are those people who are practicing the Dhamma. And Mara is trying to stop you getting enlightened. And this is actually what happens. So with that simile, the idea of Mara, letting go of attachments to the five-sense world, but still having to live in the five-sense world, how is that done? This sutta is going to explain that. But before I go any further, have you got all quite or reasonably clear the idea of Mara? Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Your responsibility is always to try and stop the involvement of Mara. I must admit that I was one of the monks who started that idea, because I remember that when we used to do these all-night sits in Thailand, and sometimes, most of the time, I was, you know, to be quite fair, I was very good. I used to stay up most nights. But every now and again, you get so tired, you sneak back to your hut and have a sleep. When other monks would say, "Ah, you won't have a sleep tonight," and I would say, "Well, who am I to fight Mara and his hordes? I'm only a small monk. This guy, you know, he's almost got the Buddha. What am I going to do to be able to fight him?" That was just like a joke and excuse. The point being is, you know the causes and effects, but that doesn't absolve you of the responsibility to try and do your very best, to put forth effort. So just to say, "Well, who am I to fight Mara?" That's still not really an excuse. Well, it's an excuse, but it's not a reason. So in other words, we're supposed to fight Mara. But the point is that, you know, how can one actually do that? Because in a sense, this being is a very powerful heavenly being with all sorts of psychic powers. For those of you who've ever read the story of the Buddha's enlightenment, just before the Buddha became enlightened, the first thing which Mara did, he came up to the Buddha and actually said, "Well, instead of becoming enlightened, why don't you become what in Buddhism we call this wheel-turning monarch? You can be just this righteous leader. You've got what it takes, you know, to lead the world as a universal emperor. And you can absolve the world of poverty. You can get rid of corruption. You can lead people into living lives of peace and harmony with prosperity in all the lands." And of course the Buddha said, "No way." He wants to be a Buddha instead. But that is always a temptation for people. Instead of becoming enlightened, let's go out and help the world and solve all the world's problems. And that's Mara speaking. And the Buddha actually knew that, and so said, no, I won't do that at all. So then Mara tried other things. He tried to stop the Buddha becoming enlightened through lust with his three daughters. And the three daughters were craving, delight, Nandi, Raga, and Danha. Delight, what do you call them? Craving and lust, I suppose you call them. And when they cavorted in front of the Buddha, and the Buddha was just not interested at all, this is fascinating just how well, you know, Buddhism understood human beings. The three daughters of Mara turned themselves into old women with the comment that men's desires are various. It was really funny. But that sort of didn't work either. So the next thing, they tried to get fear with the Mara's armies coming to try and attack the Buddha. But even fear didn't work. So you can see they were trying anything to stop the Buddha becoming enlightened. And that was Mara. Because as soon as the Buddha becomes enlightened, he's gone beyond the control of Mara. And any control freak, what upsets them the most is if they cannot control you. They'll do their utmost to try and keep you under their power. Which is why, as I was saying on Friday night, if someone tries to control you with abuse, or with trying to make you afraid, like terrorists, or, you know, trying to make you angry, like people sometimes do, shouting terrible words at you, don't allow them to control you. It's up to you just to say, "No, I'm not going to not do these things because you want me to be afraid. I'm not going to stop doing these things because you're scolding me. I am not going to allow anyone to control my happiness. I'm going to decide what is necessary for me to do. I'm just going to do it." So that Mara is a control freak which tries to stop you doing what is good and what will liberate you from samsara. But in this particular sutta, the Mara tries to keep you in samsara by offering you the delights of the five senses. Beautiful sights such as sunsets or flowers or seeing your first child born. Beautiful sounds like Jimi Hendrix, but that's when I was young, not these days. Or like Bach or Vivaldi or something. Or beautiful, whatever you got, beautiful smells, like, you know, scents and perfumes. Or beautiful tastes, such as, you know, your local restaurant or beautiful touches such as sex, or whatever else turns you on, as they say. But all these are trying to keep you attached to this world, and that's like Mara's bait. And that's always there. Obviously for monks, you know, we're celibate, but still there's the sights, there's the sounds, there's the smells, still there's the delicious food. Still is, you know, you're living in the world as a monk or as a practitioner. So how can you escape Mara's bait? This is the story here. So has someone else had the question? Yes, John? Yeah, but they're all really the same. Because your past karma is what creates the defilements of the present. And Mara, the defilements, is what weakens you, so that you are at the mercy of Mara. So that gives weaknesses in your armor, so you cannot withstand sort of the temptations of not just the flesh, the temptations of the eye, the ear, the nose, the tongue, and the body. Of course, you all know the answer, at least you should if you've been around here long enough, of how to withstand Mara. But here you can see it, spoken, not by Ajahn Brahm, but by the Buddha. So here we go, Nirvapa Sutta, the bait. Thus have I heard, on one occasion the Blessed One was living at Sarvati in Jeta's Grove, Anathapindika's Park. There he addressed the monks. Thus, monks, Venerable Sir, they replied, the Blessed One said this. Standard opening. Bhikkhus, a deer trapper does not lay down bait for a deer herd, intending thus, may the deer herd enjoy this bait that I have laid down, and so be long-lived and handsome and endure for a long time. No, a deer trapper lays down bait for a deer herd, intending thus, ha-ha, the deer herd will eat the food unwarily, by going right in amongst the bait that I have laid down. By so doing, they will become intoxicated. When they are intoxicated, they will fall into negligence. And when they are in negligence, I can do with them as I like on account of that bait. Now, the word intoxicant is intoxicant here. Very great word in Pali because they have many types of intoxication. The two which I always remember is the intoxication of youth. Which means you're young and you think you're always young, you can do whatever you want, whenever you want. You know, sort of the young person's idea. And that's like an intoxication of youth. The other intoxication I remember reading is the intoxication of health. You're lovely and healthy, you can do whatever you want, and you think you're going to be healthy forever. Like you're going to be young forever. So there's a sense of like delusion with these intoxications, just as the word intoxication is meant these days when you take too much alcohol, you're not seeing things clearly. So it's not really seeing clearly what it means by intoxication here with the bait, whatever that bait is. So you really get into it, you're not seeing the dangers. It's a sense of, I'm having a great time, it will last forever, nothing wrong. So that's what intoxication, because of intoxication we get to negligence. We're enjoying ourselves. And like a person who's intoxicated with youth becomes negligent, thinking the youth will last forever, sometimes they do stupid things, which they pay for in their later years, and most of you are in those later years now, and you know what I mean. And, yeah, okay, you're bending your leg now, you know what I mean. And this is what happens. So that's intoxication of youth, intoxication of health as well. And you become negligent. When you're healthy, you think, I don't need to exercise, I don't need to eat right, I don't need to look after, I'm healthy, I've got no problem. And of course, that's an intoxication which leads to negligence, which leads to the problem. So, by eating the food unwarily, they become intoxicated. Through intoxicant, they become negligent, and then Mara has control over you. So don't put out the bait just so other people can have fun. Now the deer of the first herd ate food unwarily by going right in amongst the bait that the deer trapper had laid down. By so doing, they became intoxicated. When they were intoxicated, they fell into negligence. When they were negligent, the deer trapper did with them as he liked on account of that bait. That is how the deer of the first herd fail to get free from the deer trapper's power and control. And of course, as soon as the deer trapper traps the deer, they either usually kill them and roast them. So it's a very dangerous thing to get trapped by a deer hunter. Now the deer of the second herd reckoned thus. The deer of that first herd, by acting as they did without precaution, failed to get free from the deer trapper's power and control. Suppose we altogether shun that bait food, shunning that fearful enjoyment, let us go out into the forest wilds and live there. And they did so. But in the last month of the hot season, when the grass and the water were used up, their bodies were reduced to extreme emaciation. With that they lost their strength and energy. When they had lost their strength and energy, they returned to that same bait that the deer trapper had laid down. They ate food unwarily by going right in amongst it, and by so doing they became intoxicated. When they were intoxicated, they fell into negligence. And when they were negligent, the deer trapper did with them as he liked on account of that bait. And that is how the deer of the second herd also failed to get free from the deer trapper's power and control. Well, they're saying here that you have to take some of that bait. So how on earth can you do it? If you leave it alone altogether, you get so hungry that you can't help yourself in the end. Now the deer of a third herd reckon thus. The deer of that first herd, by acting as they did without precaution, failed to get free from the deer trapper's power and control. Now the deer of that second herd, by reckoning how the deer of the first herd had failed, and by planning and acting as they did, with the precaution of going to live in the forest wilds, also failed to get free from the deer trapper's power and control. Suppose we make our dwelling place within range of the deer trapper's bait. Then, having done so, we shall eat food, not unwarily, and without going right in amongst the bait that the deer trapper has laid down. And by doing so, we shall not become intoxicated. When we are not intoxicated, we shall not fall into negligence. When we are not negligent, that deer trapper shall not do with us as he likes on account of that bait. And they did so. So they lived a while away from the bait. When the deer trapper wasn't around, they go and take some, and then they go away again. But then the deer trapper and his following considered thus. These deer of this third herd are as cunning and crafty as wizards and sorcerers. A wizard here is an idiomanta, some people with psychic powers. And sorcerers here is literally means people who know what others are doing. In other words, read other people's minds. So these deer of this third herd are as cunning and crafty as powerful wizards and mind readers. They eat the bait laid down without unknowing how they come and go. Suppose we have the bait that is laid down, completely surrounded all round over a wide area with wicker hurdles. Then perhaps we might see the third deer's herd's dwelling place and where they go to hide, because they have to sort of break through, or at least scrape past those hurdles to be able to get into the enclosure where the bait is, and there they get some idea of how they get in, and they can track them to find out where they're hiding. They did so, and they saw the third herd's dwelling place where they went to hide. And that is how the deer of the third herd also failed to get free from the deer trapper's power and control. Now the deer of a fourth herd reckoned thus. The deer of that first herd, by acting as they did without precaution, failed to get free from the deer trapper's power and control. The deer of that second herd, by reckoning how the deer of the first herd had failed, and by planning and acting as they did with precaution of going to live in the forest wilds, also failed to get free from the deer trapper's power and control. And the deer of that third herd, by reckoning how the deer of the first herd and also the deer of the second herd had failed, and by planning and acting as they did, with the precaution of making their dwelling place within range of the deer trapper's bait, also failed to get free from the deer trapper's power and control. Suppose we make our dwelling place where the deer trapper and his following cannot go. Then, having done so, we shall eat food not unwarily, and without going right in amongst the bait that the deer trappers lay down. And by doing so, we shall not become intoxicated. When we are not intoxicated, we shall not fall into negligence. When we are not negligent, the deer trapper shall not do with us as he likes on account of that bait. And they did so. So they found a place to hide where the deer trapper cannot go. But they could always come out, eat the bait, take something to eat, and then rush off before the deer trapper comes back to follow them and catch them. But then the deer trapper and his following considered thus: these deer of this fourth herd are as cunning and crafty as powerful wizards and mind readers. They eat the bait laid down without our knowing how they come and go. Suppose we have the bait that is laid down completely surrounded all around over a wide area with wicker hurdles. Then perhaps we might see the fourth deer herd's dwelling place where they go to hide. They did so, but they did not see the fourth deer herd's dwelling place where they went to hide. Because they were hiding in a place where the deer hunter could not go. Then the deer herd and his following considered thus: if we scare the fourth deer herd, being scared they might alert others, and so the deer herds will all desert this bait that we have laid down. Suppose we treat the fourth deer herd with indifference, and they did so. And that was how the deer of the fourth deer herd got free from the deer trapper's power and control. They were just too clever for the deer hunter. Now, of course, in those days, that would be a simile which all the monks and the villagers would know, because there were people who were going to the forest to trap the deer, to eat. So now the Buddha explains the meaning of the simile. Monks, I have given this simile in order to convey a meaning. This is a meaning. Bait is the term for the five cords of sensual pleasure. And what are those five cords of sensual pleasure? It is whatever is seen with the eye, heard with the ear, smelt with the nose, tasted with the tongue, felt with the body, which is pleasurable and enjoyable. That is the bait. Deer trapper is a term for Mara. He's trying to trap you. And they call him the evil one. Evil is not really a good word, but they have this word papa, which is like basically the bad guy, always trying to sort of trick people. It's actually where in Thai, the Thai word is bap. That's bad karma. It comes to the word papa. And the deer trapper's following is a term for Mara's following. And the deer herd is a term for recluses and Brahmins. In other words, anyone who is aspiring to become enlightened. So you are the deer herd. Now, recluses and Brahmins of the first kind ate food unwarily by going right in amongst the bait and the material things of the world. That's really great here where the Buddha said it's not just food, it's all the material pleasures of the world, whatever that happens to be, whether it's for monks, the fine robes you can wear, or your new MP3 player, or whatever else the monks get into these days, or your new house, your new car, or your new clothes, whatever it is, your material possessions are here looked by the Buddha as being the bait, part of the five sense pleasures and the material possessions. Now the point is, if you heard myself say and other monks and nuns say, as you heard his say, you're not saying not to have these things, because you find out from the second herd what happens when you don't have these things. You have to learn how to be able to use that bait without intoxication. So, recluses and Brahmins of the first kind ate food unwarily by going right in amongst the bait and the material things of the world that Mara had laid down. By so doing, they became intoxicated. When they were intoxicated, they fell into negligence. And when they were negligent, Mara did with them as he liked on account of that bait and those material things of the world. That is how the recluses and Brahmins of the first kind fail to get free from Mara's power and control. These recluses and Brahmins, I say, just like the deer of the first herd. Now, just on the side here, as monks, especially of the forest tradition, we're very careful of this, because I've seen it even in my lifetime. When I was a young monk, the village monasteries were the wealthy ones, because they'd be invited to all the ceremonies and do all the chanting and the funerals. And so they'd get lots of support and all the best food. And as forest monks, we found fine, because they could leave us alone. But because they got all the fine food and lots of material support, if you go like to village monasteries, they may accept money and have TVs in their rooms and all sorts of stuff. You can see that they have trodden unwarily and become intoxicated with the material things of the world, and Mara can do with them what they like. So because of that, they actually lost their way, and their precepts aren't as good. They're not seen by ordinary people as being very inspiring. And so because of that, in my lifetime, people looked at the village monasteries and say, we don't want to invite them or look after them. And they saw the forest monks. The forest monks who are living very simply, eating just a meal a day in their bowl and living in simple huts. So what did they do? They started inviting them to all the ceremonies and do all the chanting, to do their funeral service. And also they started offering lots of money to them. And so their huts became bigger and more opulent. And that becomes the problem. Because it's like Mara takes his bait to those monks and nuns who are the ones who are really trying to do something to become enlightened. The more holy you seem to become, the more people give you gifts and invite you to give talks on TV and radio. And this is obviously the problem. The closer you are to enlightenment, the more desperate Mara becomes to try and do anything to stop you. The more he throws more bait in your path. And this first herd, they weren't careful. They became intoxicated by the food and the material things of the world. And they got under Mara's control. Attachments and cravings. And they could not escape. Father, the Buddha always told the monks, when you become a senior monk and you become well known, you've got to be very careful of labha sakkara saloka, which is gains, honor, and fame. So that's a great danger, and all monks should be very careful of that. Anyone should be. However, there is an escape. Now, recluses and Brahmins of the second kind reckon thus. Those recluses and Brahmins of the first kind, by acting as they did without precaution, fail to get free from Mara's power and control. Suppose we all together shun that bait food and those material things of the world, shunning that fearful enjoyment. Let us go out into the forest wilds and live there. And they did so. They were eaters of greens, basically grass, whatever was growing in the forest. And or millet, or wild rice, or hide parings, or moss, or rice bran, or the discarded scum of boiled rice, or sesame flour, or grass, or even cow dung, they would eat. And they lived on forest roots and fruits. They fed on fallen fruits. In other words, this is like the hermits who go off and you never ever see them. And they just live, just whenever they can gather in the forest. But in the last month of the hot season, when the grass and the water were used up, their bodies were reduced to extreme emaciation. With that, they lost their strength and energy. When they had lost their strength and energy, they lost their deliverance of mind. I'll mention these afterwards. With the loss of their deliverance of mind, they returned to that same bait that Mara had laid down and those material things of the world. They ate food unwarily by going right in amongst it. By so doing, they became intoxicated. When they were intoxicated, they fell into negligence. And when they were negligent, Mara did with them as he liked on account of that bait and those material things of the world. That is how those recluses and Brahmins of the second kind fail to get free from Mara's power and control. Those recluses and Brahmins, I say, are just like the deer of the second herd. So this is when somebody just goes deep into the forest and just tries to live on whatever is there. But they find it impossible because sometimes those things run out. And so eventually they come back to the bait. And as soon as they, especially if you haven't sort of had many sensory pleasures for a long time, the first sensory pleasure you have, it just blows you away. I remember after 7 years as a monk in northeast Thailand, I went to visit my family in England for the first time. And I got an economy ticket on Philippine Airlines. I remember that. It was like a junk airline at the time. But when I went to sit in there, I'd never seen such luxury in 7 years. Padded seats, for goodness sake. I hadn't seen a cushion in 7 years. And the whole thing was just wow. Now, for ordinary people, it was just, you know, you probably complain about economy class in Philippine Airlines, sort of about 25 years ago. For me, it was just luxurious, and I couldn't believe it, because I'd been in the forest for seven years doing it tough. So this is what happens. Eventually, you have to come and take that bait. Eventually, you have to, you know, get fine food or be amongst material things. But if you're like the second herd, you get caught whenever you first see it. This is one of the problems here. So just staying away and thinking these things don't exist will not solve the problem. As Ajahn Chah was used to say when he first heard the story of the three monkeys, see no evil, hear no evil, speak no evil. He said that's a very stupid monkey as a result. He said that's not the way. So, see what is the way. So that second herd. Any questions so far before we carry on? Okay, the third herd. Now, recluses and Brahmins of the third kind reckon thus. Those recluses and Brahmins of the first kind, by acting as they did without precaution, failed to get free from Mara's power and control. Those recluses and Brahmins of the second kind, by reckoning how the recluses and Brahmins of the first kind had failed, and then planning and acting as they did with the precaution of going to live in the forest wilds, also failed to get free from Mara's power and control. Suppose we make our dwelling place within range of that bait that Mara has laid down, and those material things of the world. Then having done so, we shall eat food not unwarily, and without going right in amongst the bait that Mara has laid down, and the material things of the world. By doing so, we shall not become intoxicated. When we are not intoxicated, we shall not fall into negligence. When we are not negligent, Mara shall not do with us as he likes on account of that bait and those material things of the world. And they did so. And that's similar to, like, to good monks or nuns, people who try and live simply in the world, who, like forest monks, we put our monasteries, like in Dharmasara, you know, outside of the city, but within range of the city. Like serpentine, outside of the city, but within range of the city. So people can come and go and they can feed us, but we don't have too much material pleasures in there, so that we can use them carefully and not get intoxicated. That's why we have the forest monasteries just outside of the towns and the cities, but within range of Mara's bait, if you want. But what happened to this third herd? Remember that in the simile of the herd, Mara put all these fences around, so you can actually see where these people were staying. And they could actually find out. Sure, they would use the bait, but he would actually find out where they came from and can still exert power and control. And here, where they're coming from, is, you'll see in a few moments, is not a physical place, but your mental ideas and views, your thinking. He said, this is still where Mara can get you in your thoughts and philosophies, as we can see now. Oh, I never actually mentioned the second type of recluses and Brahmins, the ones who lived in the forest wilds, that when they could not find enough things to eat, because of their weakness and lack of energy, they lost their deliverances of mind. And those deliverances of mind are always meant to be the deep meditations. So they lost their peacefulness. And it's a very important thing here to understand that to get into things like jhanas, you do need a reasonably healthy body. I don't mean absolutely healthy, but reasonably healthy body. If you're starving, then it's very difficult to get into jhana, which is one of the reasons why the Buddha taught the middle way. Now, to be able to eat, to wash, not to indulge, but certainly not to to hurt the body. Because only when you have that middle way, that ease of the body, without indulging the body, is the body able to be let go of, so you can attend to the mind and get into the jhanas. So because this second type of recluses and Brahmins, because they living too far away, they couldn't get enough material support, they lost their strength, they lost their jhanas, and they came back into the world and they lost everything. That actually is interesting. That's sometimes what happens to some of the great gurus of all traditions. Sometimes they live very, very remote lives and they do very well for a while, and then after a time they get into the world, too many people around them, too many pleasures, too many gifts, and they tend to lose their powers. They lose their meditation. I've seen that happen a lot of times. So at the third kind, they lived close to the bait, but away from the bait, but they could find out where they were hiding by looking at their views. As it says here at the bottom of page 249, but then they came to hold such views as the world is eternal and the world is not eternal, the world is finite and the world is infinite. The soul and the body are the same, the soul is one thing and the body another, and after death the Tathagata exists, and after death the Tathagata does not exist, and after death the Tathagata both exists and does not exist, and after death the Tathagata neither exists nor does not exist. Those are like the 10 unanswerable questions. The reason why they are unanswerable, because each one of them misses a point. So it's the wrong questions, which means they're unanswerable. In other words, they got into philosophical meanderings without any idea of what was really going on. And that is how those recluses and Brahmins of the third kind failed to get free from Mara's power and control. Those recluses and Brahmins, I say, are just like the deer of the third herd. They could find out where they hung out in their philosophical meanderings. Now we get to the successful fourth herd, the aspiration of all good practitioners, which shows you what you should do to get beyond Mara, to leave samsara and become enlightened. Now, recluses and Brahmins of the fourth kind reckon thus. Those recluses and Brahmins of the first kind, by acting as they did without precaution, fail to get free from Mara's power and control. Notice how much repetition we have in the Buddha suttas. That's in order to teach everyone patience. Because you know, Westerners, get on with it. Come on, let's just summarize these things. But in Buddhism, people just patient. We'll get to it eventually. Those recluses and Brahmins of the second kind, by reckoning how the recluses and Brahmins of the first kind had failed, and by planning and acting as they did with the precaution of going to live in the forest wilds, also failed to get free from Mara's power and control. And the recluses and the Brahmins of the third kind, by reckoning how the recluses and Brahmins of the first kind, and also the recluses and Brahmins of the second kind had failed, and by planning and acting as they did, with the precaution of making their dwelling place within range of the bait of Mara, that Mara had laid down, and the material things of the world, also failed to get free from Mara's power and control. So the fourth herd thought, suppose we make our dwelling place where Mara and his following cannot go. Then, having done so, we shall eat food not unwarily and without going right in amongst the bait that Mara has laid down and the material things of the world. By doing so, we shall not become intoxicated. When we are not intoxicated, we shall not fall into negligence. When we are not negligent, Mara shall not do with us as he likes, on account of that bait and those material things of the world. And they did so. And that is how those recluses and Brahmins of the fourth kind got free from Mara's power and control. Those recluses and Brahmins, I say, are just like the deer of the fourth herd. So when they went to a place where Mara can't go, but they still would eat the food, and they were still, enter the material things of the world, but would always go back again to the place where Mara cannot go. And where do you think Mara cannot go? Yes, here we come. And where is it that Mara and his following cannot go? Here, quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states, a monk enters upon and abides in the first jhana, which is accompanied by the movement of mind onto and holding onto the object with rapture and pleasure born of seclusion. This monk is said to have blindfolded Mara, to have become invisible to the evil one by depriving Mara of its opportunity. Now, for those of you who haven't heard me talk about jhanas for a while, notice I changed a couple of those inaccurate translations over here. It is secluded from sensory pleasures. This is really is secluded from not just the bait of Mara, but even all thoughts of Mara, where the five senses completely shut down. It's actually not sensory pleasures. It doesn't say karma sukha viveka, it's karma viveka, or vivicheva kamehi, which is secluded from all the five senses, which means that the sense of seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, and touching have completely shut down. They're not operating anymore. That's why Mara can't go to those jhanas. And you've heard me say before what it's like in those jhanas where the mind cannot move, you can't make any thoughts. You can't even control your mind, let alone Mara. Just Mara just cannot go into those jhanas. I'll go on to this in a few more moments, but we go in through all the jhanas now. Again, with the stilling of applied and sustained movement of the mind, no thinking happens anywhere close to the jhanas. A monk enters upon and abides in a second jhana, which, again, is a terrible translation here, which has the inner confidence of the bliss and the oneness of mind. The bliss of that jhana is the only thing existing in the mind, unchanging, without any movement of the mind, with the rapture and pleasure born of that oneness, that singleness, that stillness called samadhi, concentration. This bhikkhu is also said to have blindfolded Mara to become invisible to the evil one by depriving Mara of its opportunity. Again, with a fading away of rapture, pity, a monk abides in equanimity and mindful and fully aware, still feeling pleasure with that experience. There's nobody here. Enters upon and abides in the third jhana, on account of which the noble ones announce they have a pleasant abiding who has equanimity and is mindful. This monk is said to have blindfolded Mara, to have become invisible to the evil one by depriving Mara of his opportunity. And again, with the abandoning of all physical and mental pleasure and pain, this is joy and grief as a mental happiness and displeasure, a monk enters upon abides in the fourth jhana, which is neither pain nor pleasure, purity of mindfulness due to equanimity. This monk is said to have blindfolded Mara to become invisible to the evil one by depriving Mara of its opportunity. And again, with the complete surmounting of perceptions of form, with the disappearance of perceptions of sensory impact, with non-attention to perceptions of diversity, aware that space is, without limits, I forget the word I've used when I describe this, a monk enters upon and abides in the base of unlimited space. This monk is said to have blindfolded Mara, have become invisible to the evil one by depriving Mara of its opportunity. And again, by completely surmounting the base of infinite space with a perception consciousness is unlimited, a monk a monk enters upon and abides in the base of undefined consciousness. This monk is said to have blindfolded Mara, to have become invisible to the evil one by depriving Mara of his opportunity. And again, by completely surmounting the base of infinite or unlimited consciousness, aware there is nothing, the monk enters upon and abides in the base of nothingness at all. This monk is said to have blindfolded Mara, to have become invisible to the evil one by depriving Mara's eye of its opportunity. Again, by completely surmounting the perception of nothingness, a monk enters upon and abides in the perception of neither perception nor non-perception. The monk is said to have blindfolded Maya, to have become invisible to the evil one by depriving Maya's eye of its opportunity. Now those are like the four jhanas and the immaterial jhanas, and many of you haven't been there, let alone Maya. So you can understand why it's going to a place where very few people go, and certainly Maya can't go there. You know why Maya can't go into the jhanas? Because he's a control freak. Why haven't you got into jhanas yet? Yes, good on you. Well done. Control. So it's all letting go, abandoning. Yes. Aha. Actually, no, the qualifications of jhana is, of Maya, is probably just by being a really sort of generous, charitable guy. He probably was someone who sort of ran some charity. Just, you know, probably with an iron fist. Or did some really good social work, you know, but sort of was very, very strong. Did a lot of good for the world, you know, some sort of prime minister, but sort of told a lot of people off. There's a lot of times that people who get into positions of compassionate power, sometimes they get so controlling after a while. This is how we're going to help the world. And you do what I say. I know. So you can still, you know, do lots and lots of good karma, but still be a bit of a control freak. But you don't get to those places for the jhanas. The jhanas, you get to the Brahma realm and beyond, which is very fascinating. These are people who have done lots and lots of kindness, lots and lots of good karma, lots of charity and generosity. People have been kind and compassionate, but haven't learned yet how to let go of controlling. Have you ever seen people who, you know, run charities or work for charities or work for the committee of a Buddhist society or whatever it is? They're doing really, really good work, but sometimes they can become a bit controlling. So you can see actually how you can get into that position. And all these people in power, they all think they're doing the good, best thing for everybody else, but they do become controllers. Exactly. It all comes down to the sense of me. Now, I am the spiritual dictator of the Buddhist Society of West Australia. Well, I am the head of World Vision, or I am the head of Samaritans, or whatever it is. And I'm here because I know I've got the experience. You should follow me. So you can become the control freak there. But with all these wonderful aspirations, you really want to do something good for the world. And sure, you know, you start off with wonderful motives, but the power trip gets you. That is the problem. That is Maya. And it all comes from the ego, the sense of self. It increases it, yes. Yeah. Correct. So what you have to do here, you have to go to where Maya and his following cannot go. Here, quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states, the bhikkhu enters upon and abides in the jhanas. This is the whole point of this simile here, that you can't avoid sort of the five sense world, the bait. You can't avoid the material things of this world. If you do, just like the second herd, you go deep into some wilderness, sooner or later, you know, there's nothing to eat, you can't survive. So you have to come back to sort of get some food. You have to give talks to get donations to build retreat centers, or just to, you know, pay the bills for your monks. So you have to get involved there. But if you're just, this is a third herd, you can't stay outside. That's the lesson of the second herd. If you get too close, the third herd, you get caught. The only solution is this fourth herd, who has a place where they can hang out, where Maya can't go. So they go to their place deep in the forest where Mara can't go. Not the physical place, but the mental place of the jhanas. And then they can come out, and they can eat the food, they can be among the material things of the world, but they don't get caught up in it. Why? Because they've got their place where they hide the jhanas. That's a powerful thing which I keep trying to mention to people in monastic life. I mentioned this to the monk so many times. If you get those jhanas, you'll be safe as a monk. If you don't, you'll be like the third herd or the second herd or whatever. You will not be able to survive. Or you may be able to survive, but not really well. You'll always be in danger of getting lured by Mara. Pretty girl comes along, fall in love, and you end up disrobing. Or you stay as a monk, but you start having great palaces, big huts which you live in with TV screens, and you just watch the TV just because of, you've got to be able to have some stuff which you can relate to the world. You know, you've got to be able to understand how people think. You tend to go and justify your defilements. And that's where you get lost. Yeah, you've got to have a resource. You've got to have a place which puts everything in perspective. If you don't have that place which puts things into perspective, you don't have your jhanas, you do get caught by Mara. So there's a failure of the second herd, the third herd. They were outside the range of Mara, but close enough Mara could catch them. They weren't going to places where Mara can't go, where the controller, sensory pleasures and all stuff like that don't exist. It doesn't matter if it was a cause of Mara or your own fault. You're the one who has to get suffers as a result. It is part of the process as well. You need to have a wholesome thought. You don't get it right. As long as you reflect afterwards and become better as a result, you acknowledge, forgive, and learn. In a sense, it is. Yeah, it just depends which way you look at it. So the metaphorical Mara or the real Mara, you can look at it on both ways. So you got caught. Or the controller within or the controller without. So you got into controlling. Yeah, to restrain. It restrains your controlling mind. So at least you can't kill people, which is like called pest control. to kill your pests. Learn from it, yeah. Acknowledge, forgive, and learn. And we've also just gone through all of the jhanas there. Any one of them, Mara just cannot go there. And the reason is, again, that Mara lives in what we call Karma Loka. There's three, if you like, universes in Buddhism. That's why every now and again you hear the word Tiloka, the three worlds, the three universes. And Karma Loka literally means the universe of the five senses. The universe which is built up of seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting and touching. And the beings of those universes are the hell realms, the animal realms, the ghosts, the human realms, and the lower Deva realms, up to Mara and just above the Brahma realm, which straddles, it's almost on the edge of Karma Loka, and the next world is called Rupa Loka, the jhana realms. And these are beings who are in the jhanas. And this is beings in this realm have what they call manomaya kaya, mind-made bodies. So made of the experience of jhana, but not able to converse with each other, because if you've ever been in a jhana, you're so still, you're just in a bliss state, existing for long periods of time. And the other realm is the sanyamaya kaya, made of perceptions, which is the immaterial jhanas. The perception of infinite space, perception of infinite consciousness, the perception of nothingness, perception, neither perception or non-perception. These are the perception states where the being exists there. Just made of perception, that's all there is. Just in bliss. As I say sometimes, eating that bliss, nurtured by it for long periods of time. The three realms. And those other realms, just Mara, just cannot go. That's why one of the suttas there, the Buddha went up to see Brahma, who is like the God, like the Allah or the Jehovah. And I think this is, was it the Brahmani Mantanika Sutta? I think that's in here somewhere. And in that, the Brahma actually said, you know, you should worship me, Gautama Buddha. I am the firstborn, the Lord of all that is, blah, blah, blah. And the Buddha said, no, you're not. And said, yes, I am. No, you're not. And the Buddha said, I'm more powerful than you. No, you're not. And the God said, I will disappear from you, monk. And the Buddha said, no, you can't. And so the Brahma disappeared from the Buddha, but the Buddha was there. So Brahma could not disappear from the Buddha, but the Buddha said, I can disappear from you, God. And so the Buddha disappeared. And the God said, where's he gone? Where's he gone? I can't see him. I don't know where he's gone. It never actually says what happens there, but it's, I think, pretty clear to me that Brahma God can actually enter the first jhana and comes out of the first jhana again. That's why the devas in that realm said that every now and again that they see Brahma appearing with a big light appears, and then he comes. They don't know where he comes from, but he comes always with a big light, and he goes away, the big light, and then he disappears again. Now, what's that big light called? Sorry? Nimitta, yeah, Nimitta. Just what happens before you get into a jhanas. It's beautiful light, and then you enter it. So that's obviously what Brahma was doing. So Brahma tried to get into first jhana, but the Buddha can go into first jhana as well, obviously. So he could not escape from the Buddha. But the Buddha can go into second jhana. That's where Brahma can't go. As far as Mara is concerned, he can't get into first jhana. He's such a control freak. You know one of the reasons why Brahma can get into first jhana? Because one of the things with Brahma, he gets to the state of being a Brahma through lots of loving kindness. And what's loving kindness? The door of my heart's open, no matter. It's unconditional. Letting go. So loving kindness is another way of getting into a jhana. Because it's embracing whatever is happening. Love is the opposite of controlling. And the unconditional love of metta, that is. That just takes you into a jhana realm. That's why Brahma can get there through loving kindness. Can only get to the first jhana. But the Buddha goes second, third, all the way through. So Mara can't go into any jhanas. That's what blindfolds Mara. Where's he gone? Where's this monk gone? I don't know where he lives, where he hangs out. Brahma can get into first jhana, but no further. Where can you go? And just to end off the sutta here, the Buddha just goes a bit further than jhana. Again, by completely surmounting the base of neither perception nor non-perception, a monk enters upon and abides in a cessation of perception and feeling. That's when everything, perception is all gone. So you're not perceiving anything. No perception left. Feeling. Feeling is this word, vedana, pleasure, pain, or anything in between, all that absolutely ceased. It's a cessation of mind. We're all knowing, all perceiving, everything gone. And his taints are destroyed by his seeing with wisdom. His taints, like the defilements, this is the outgoings of the mind. You see with wisdom based on the data of that experience. And when our taints are destroyed, you are enlightened. That monk is said to have blindfolded Mara, to become invisible to the evil one by depriving Mara of his opportunity, like all the other jhana ones. But also, he's said to have crossed beyond attachment to the world. In the jhanas, you have deprived Mara of his opportunity, but there's still a possibility of attachment to the world. But when you've done this last destruction of the outgoings of the mind, then you have crossed beyond all attachment to all worlds. That is what the Blessed One said. The monks were satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. So the reason I love that sutta is because it's another celebration of the importance of jhanas, which I often sort of keep on making much of in my talks. It's very clear there, that's the only place where you blindfold Mara, where Mara can't go, you deprive him of his opportunity. Otherwise, the controller can always catch you. And the things of the world, the pleasures of the world, the material things of the world, they will always catch you. So even like good monks or nuns, good practitioners, you know, you really want to do the very best. You know, you're trying to become enlightened. But just the things of the world are just too sticky. You know, you can't really get rid of them. You can't really let them go. And you just get caught up in them. Whether it's your family, someone gets sick or they die. You know, you tend to grieve and get upset. Or, you know, the things of the world, you know, that new plasma screen TV, it just looks really nice. You know, well, why not? I can afford it. So Mara gets you. So the only way, and especially for monks and nuns, you see this so often, that monks and nuns get caught up into worldly things. Why is that? You know, it's not just, oh monks, you should please keep your vinaya. We can help you keep your vinaya or whatever it is. Unless the monks have got the jhanas, that's the only way they'll escape the deer hunter. And that's the only way you can escape the deer hunter as well. It's a powerful simile there which the Buddha gave. That's why I love it. So, how many of you are going to come on the retreats? Or how many of you are going to go? What does that say here? How many of you are going to go right amongst the bait? And where is it going? Unwary, go right amongst the bait, the Mara's laid down, the material things of the world have become intoxicated and negligent. Now, so Mara can do with you as he likes. So maybe if you get the jhanas, you see those ads, the stupid ads on the TV, yeah, I don't need that. But if you haven't got the jhanas, you say, oh, that's interesting. Oh, yeah, I wouldn't mind going there. Oh, yeah, I might want that sort of new car, whatever else it is. So you'll always see those ads, but don't get intoxicated. Yes, of course, it's a growing nibbida is the standard phrase. Nibbida means a turning away from the things of the world. You know, what am I doing this for? You're just repulsed from the world. You know, the mind just is forced away from the world. But the usual way is from samadhi. Sama samadhi is always jhana. You see things as they really are. You're not deluded. And because of that lack of delusion, you turn away from the world, which is nibbida. Because you turn away from the world just fades away. Yes. Seeing things as they truly are. But this is a natural process. It's not you, oh, I've done samadhi, now what should I do next? That is Mara again, controlling. It just happens naturally. No, you don't ask your spiritual director. That's the spiritual director stepping in as Mara. Not even a Sangha. You just let go and you stop controlling. You stop even asking the questions, what should I do next? So that's all Mara getting in there. Do something next. So no, don't do anything at all. Let it go. Next up, usually the longer I become a monk, the more irresponsible I become. play responsibly. You don't think about things so much. Just allow them to happen. And when you... when you do think about them, you start planning things out, it always goes something different and you realize what a waste of time that was, worrying and planning it. Yeah. That's right, yeah. It all works out somehow or other. And it's nothing to do with me. I am not in control. Things just happen. And just sometimes people get upset at me that way. They ask me, when am I coming? What am I doing? I don't know. Maybe later on, sometime. Of course it's a great relief. So you don't have to worry so much. So you don't have to put all this stuff in your head, which people have to put in their head. And all this worry. Because I have huge responsibilities. I know sometimes I see people have got sort of a fraction of responsibility I have, and they worry so much. What are you worrying about that for? It's a big deal. It's just Mara gets in your head and makes you worry. Come on, it might go wrong. You might upset people. Everything will go wrong. Come on, start planning, start controlling. If you do this, then you can do that. And if that happens, then this will happen, and then something else will happen. Just Mara. Okay, is that enough for today? Yeah, go on. Last question, and then we'll choose the next sutta. What's the karma for? What's the cause of it falling away? What falling away? What's the karma falling away? Okay, it doesn't so much fall away. It's like a cause, like a seed, almost like a virus. It can grow and grow and grow, not fall away, but it can get worse and worse and worse. Or it can just sort of disappear. And the reason why it sort of disappears is because you come on a Sunday afternoon to hear the Dhamma at Dhammaloka Buddhist Center. You get good conditioning. In other words, you get an inoculation every Friday evening and every fortnight on a Sunday afternoon, a good shot of Dhamma in the mind, which reconditions you to brainwash you to resist Mara and his hordes. And thereby, you become stronger. In other words, the bad karma just tends to just vanish. You think, what am I doing this for? It doesn't make any sense. You associate with good people, you tend to be like them and do good things. You associate with city people, you tend to do what city people do. So that's why having good friends, listening to Dhamma, meditating, keeping your precepts, that sort of, again, it sort of grows and grows and grows. And you become stronger and stronger. So the more you keep your precepts, the easier it is to keep the precepts. The more you meditate, the easier it is to meditate. You're creating more and more good karma, which supports the whole path. When you get into jhanas, then it's a doddle all the way through. So it says dormant, yeah, because it's... could ripen at any time, but I always think the bad karma, the way it really does ripen is because you're actually open for that ripening. Now, why do you have bad memories sometimes? This is one of the things which I concentrate a lot when I'm speaking to lay people. Why is it that when we think about the past, we always remember the bad stuff? Why is it we allow bad karma from the past to keep coming up? When we've made huge amounts of good karma, can't we tap into the good karma instead? Can't we tap into the wonderful things which we've done? Well, there's always going to be bad karma unresolved. There's lots of good karma unresolved. So I'm going to resolve the good karma before I do the bad karma. If you resolve all the good karma, first of all, you can get to such a deep state of meditation and get to be someone like a stream winner. You move beyond the bad karma. The bad karma can't catch you anymore. Yeah, so I just say, keep on doing the good karma and keeping that in mind. And that gives you a lot of happiness, a lot of joy, which powers your meditation, which gets you into jhana, which sees things they truly are, and you get out of samsara before karma can catch you. Bad karma can catch you. So a wonderful way of getting out. We understand what karma is and how it actually works. And why do some people, you know, get bad karma? It's almost they look for it. They look for something to sort of upset themselves. It's just that negative way of looking in the mind. So don't look for the faults in the world. If you start looking for the faults in the world and being very critical to yourself and to others, you're opening the mind up for bad karma to come up from the past. If you're always forgiving to others, if you have gratitude to others, always seeing the wonderful side of things, then actually you are encouraging the good karma of the past to come up. It's the way to go. And that's why you get into jhanas, your positive mind. Joyful. Okay, if you're going through suffering, you come out the other side, you learn from it. Yeah, you do learn from it. But it's much better to learn from the happiness. Does it want? No, you don't have to. No, this is one of the mistakes of human beings, I think. You don't have to go through the suffering to learn from it. You don't have to have cancer to know what cancer is. You don't have to go to prison to know how bad prison is. So you don't have to do these things, but learn instead. People like to learn from their mistakes, but I've often mentioned you learn much more from your successes than you do from your mistakes. Sorry? Yeah, but you have to deal with it. So you also deal with your wonderful things which happen to you as well. And then you're actually encouraging good karma to come up. Let the past go. Let the mistakes go. But keep the good stuff. Okay, afterwards, yes. Okay. So, I'm determined to finish on time for once. And I think I've just about done it.